I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Friday. It's August 27th, 48 degrees, currently here in Old Town Park City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Guiboy. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie, and happy Friday, everyone. Made it to the end of the week. And unfortunately, the same theme that we've been dealing with over the last couple of days is going to continue to be a theme. And I'm mentioning the patchy smoke that we're going to continue to see, not only for today, but into your Saturday, possibly into Sunday. With our wind switching a little bit more out of the southwest as we move into Sunday, we might be able to see a little bit of reprieve in the smoke, but don't be surprised if you still find smoke in the sky as we make our way into Sunday. Other than that, we're going to find a lot of sunshine mixed in with that patchy smoke, and temperatures are going to be climbing to the upper 70s this afternoon, temperatures falling back to the lower 50s. And I also want to make mention before I move on here that we will also be looking at unhealthy air for sensitive groups with our air quality, and that's mainly along the Wasatch Front, maybe a little bit better as you get up towards Park City, but it's just something to keep in mind. And what we get today will be more or less on repeat for tomorrow. High temperatures will be in the upper 70s, lows dropping into the lower 50s as we move into your Saturday night. Maybe a little bit more sunshine, a little bit less smoke as we move into Sunday, and because of that, temperatures will be climbing into the lower 80s, so it will be a little bit warmer as we turn the page from the latter stages of the weekend into early next week, where we'll be with overnight lows Sunday night into Monday morning in the middle 50s, lower 80s heading into Monday. And I mentioned prior that we're going to see our wind switching more out of the southwest. It looks like at this point we're going to start to see a little bit of moisture working its way across Utah, making its way northward. And by Tuesday, we'll introduce the chance for a few showers. Temperatures will start to cool off a little bit from Tuesday into Wednesday and Thursday. Each day at this point does look like it's going to bring a slight chance for showers as temperatures will fall back more to the middle and lower 70s for daytime highs, and overnight lows will continue in the 50s.
Thomas, thank you. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And a big thank you to all of you who made your pledges of support to KPCW during the last 4 days, our most successful pledge drive ever in the history of this station, going on now 41 years. Preliminary numbers up to about $356,000. Could not have done it without the great businesses who donated premiums, without the terrific nonprofits who rallied their troops to support the cause and the mission of KPCW to let, them... They get the word out about their organizations. I mean, I'm looking at the, rundown here of the local news hour, and we've got three nonprofit organizations, the Climbing Alliance, the Summit County Arts Council, the Early Childhood Alliance. And again, these folks coming out to support KPCW and getting their supporters again to do that. So again, a big thank you. Never too late to donate to your community radio station, kpcw.org. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we've got, I believe, a Mountain Trails report with Laura Smith. Also, later on, be checking in with Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Crystal Simons. Early childhood expert Elliot Haspel discusses the critical issue of early childhood education and care in Summit County. He'll be joined by Early Childhood Alliance Director Kristen Schultz. Summit County Arts Council Marketing Manager Leslie Chavez with details on tomorrow's Arts on the Trail, and the Executive Director of the Salt Lake Climbing Alliance, Julia Geisler, with details about the 8th Annual Salt Lake Climbing Festival. Taking a look at some local news now, the Park City Planning Commission got an in-depth look at parking and circulation plans for the proposed development of Deer Valley Snow Park parking lots on Wednesday. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
After a project introduction last month, the Park City Planning Commission dove headfirst into Deer Valley's vision for how skiers will get to and from the mountain. The biggest changes on that front include moving all parking underground and reconfiguring Deer Valley Drive into two separate transit and day skier routes. The proposal would turn Deer Valley Drive south into the primary road used by buses. Day skier and other traffic would be rerouted on Deer Valley Drive north and east. Both routes would feature turnarounds and drop-off and loading zones. Project Director Peter Pillman said Deer Valley isn't trying to push one particular transit solution and would be open to alternate proposals.
There's a lot of flexibility with this, which is nice, right? So we've got it's not like some situations where you're really boxed into a corner and there's only one kind of solution and then you're trying to force, something to work. Here, because of things, we've got a lot of different ways to come up with the right solutions to the problem. And we just have to make sure we're asking the question all the time, what's the problem we're solving? But from a design point of view, we really feel like there's a lot of flexibility here and ways for us to come up with solutions.
Deer Valley also presented a schedule that would have approvals granted before the new year and construction beginning in the spring of 2022. Members of the Planning Commission called the timeline aggressive, and Commission Chair John Phillips said in his experience, large projects of this nature usually take longer to work through than when they are first proposed. Members of the public also got a chance to weigh in. John Lindell is a 20-year resident of the Fawn Grove condos and a member of the Lower Deer Valley Coalition. He expressed concerns for issues like building heights and construction noise, but singled out how the changes to circulation would affect bus riders who live to the north and east of the ponds on Deer Valley Drive.
And we are worried about traffic and parking like everybody, and we're looking forward to more clarity on that. I'm worried about one thing that has not come up with the current proposal is going to reduce the bus service that services the residents on the east side. And I'd like you to know that a little better. I just know there are going to be fewer buses going that way.
Commissioner Kristen Van Dyne added that Deer Valley must prioritize how non-motorized traffic accesses the base area during the summer months.
The multi-use paths need to be bigger, but there's so much bike traffic around Deer Valley. And in general, I feel like around Park City that keeping multi-use trails are great, but also trying to sort out the bike traffic is essential.
No votes or decisions were made on the project. The next Planning Commission meeting on Snow Park is scheduled for September 22nd. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission met on Tuesday, and on the phone with an update, I have Commissioner Crystal Simons. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the Planning Commission discussing the Ivers Village proposal, including a conversion of their old residential home to commercial and office space, also building a new office structure of some 15 to 20,000 square feet. Just in terms of location, are we talking about the corner of State Road 224 and White Pine Canyon Road?
That's right. That's where the old Red Barn is located currently.
Okay. Does that stay or get remodeled or come down?
The plan that the Ivers family brought forth to the commission on Tuesday does keep the old Red Barn in place, as well as the old historic home that's on site currently too. They want to convert the use from residential to being some office space. The old Red Barn already has a conditional use permit that allows it to be office space. And the idea is to add an additional building, a third structure that would be new construction, but it would be built to look historic to accommodate the additional new square footage for commercial that they're requesting.
Okay, so in looking at provision 2.3 of the development code, can this new entitlement be justified by some compelling benefit, or does that even play into this application?
Well, 2.3 certainly does play into the application. I think that's the question at hand. The proposal came to the Planning Commission as a working session item, which means that we weren't making decisions about it or voting on it. The commission decided that we gave feedback to the Ivers family, and they'll have to come back to us with a proposal that does demonstrate compliance, or at least a recognition of policy 2.3 to show a countervailing public interest within their proposal.
Yeah, so do we know how much traffic this will generate, especially for cars having to make a left-hand turn either from White Pine Canyon Road or from 224 onto White Pine Canyon Road?
Yeah, that's a good question. That was definitely a topic of discussion, was access to the site and if there was going to be new commercial space built and who's going to be using it and at what frequency. Again, I think it's still a proposal and a design concept that's in the oven. It's not baked yet, and the applicant will have to come back and do some assessments around that.
Okay, so this does come back as a regular agenda item as opposed to just a work session item. Let's see, the Blair Frank project, commissioners didn't get any public comment about it. The Planning Commission voted to recommend it without much fuss. But we have heard that there's a lot of controversy about accessory structures. So how did the Planning Commission approve a project that is requesting a horse stable, a swimming pool and pavilion, a tennis court, and a fishing pond?
Yeah, this project is located on Old Ranch Road on a 10-acre parcel. And I think it's important for folks to remember that the Planning Commission is an administrative commission. We're not making huge decisions around things. And this particular project does comply with code and what is allowed based on the zoning of the site. What came to us was an amendment to a low impact permit that the ultimate decision is in the hands of the county development director, and they brought it to the commission so that we could review it and have a little bit of that broader conversation and oversight. But again, I think what's important to note here is that the entitlement that exists on this parcel does allow for these accessory buildings and these additional, facilities like the pool. So our unanimous decision to approve it was really a procedural one. And, we do what the code and the zoning indicates in this case.
All right. Planning Commission also looking at some possible changes to the development code on riparian and landscaping requirements. For instance, do you limit the amount of grass and turf on a property? Where's the thinking going on that?
I'm glad you brought this one up, too. This was also a working session conversation. Many of the chapters within the development code are undergoing some review to bring them up to date, and really so that we can reflect within the Snyderville Basin's development code those ideals and opportunities within our community to ensure that as we continue to grow or as we grow out what's existed entitlement, we're doing it in a way that's responsible, not just for the landowners and the property rights underlying, but also for the ecosystem that we all live within. We're all in the West. We're dealing with water shortages and droughts across the country. And I think that staff is asking the commission to look at some of the language in particularly the landscape chapter. One thing to note, we didn't have the opportunity to look at the riparian chapter. That was done in a prior meeting. But in terms of landscaping and what that chapter articulates is how new development, particularly right now commercial, but questioning should we expand this into additional new development or changes in different zones, not just commercial, to be responsible about how we're using water in our community and in our region. Where is that water coming from? Is it going to be there forever? If we're requiring in the code that, for example, medians and parking lots are our lawn, is that a responsible decision to say, wait, they must be lawn, but we don't have the water to maintain them? I think the aesthetics of our landscape in Park City matter to our community, and we want to look at this language to make sure we're not putting things in there that we might have to, might tie our hands or we might have to double back on sometime in the future.
So, are we talking about perhaps just prohibiting outright sprinklers and maybe just allowing drip irrigation?
I don't think that a full prohibition on sprinklers is on the table right now, but it's worth the exercise of talking about what that might mean. What are the implications of something of that scale? And then we kind of can back it out from there and have a conversation around what kinds of technologies are out there that help us do this without it being an excessive burden to, homeowners or developers, for example. There's a lot of technology out there for water conservation within landscaping. And I think the question is, where do we find that balance in having a nice aesthetic landscape within our community that plays into the Park City ideology and landscapes and visual, while balancing our responsibility as global citizens to maybe not excessively use water? So we'll be looking back at that again and considering what technologies and what provisions in the code would make sense.
All right. So again, are we just talking new construction, or is there any talk about applying this retroactively?
There's not conversation right now of a retroactive application, but there is conversation about taking these provisions and expanding them beyond the commercial zone. Okay. And so there is, for example, large new housing developments may like Silver Creek Village may have to come into compliance with this when they're doing their landscaping in, you know, roadways, parking lots, and potentially even around residential structures.
All right. Finally, just wanted to ask you, the Planning Commission now transitioning from meetings that were entirely on Zoom to meetings that are kind of half and half. What are your feelings about going back to in-person meetings?
If you'd asked me that question, Leslie, 3 months ago, I think I would have been more comfortable with the idea of going back to in-person. But now that COVID cases are going up, I think it's most important for folks to have the option. And I think the hybrid approach, I'm really impressed with staff and IT at the county and their ability to accommodate both needs. We had examples in this last meeting where folks were in person and making public comments successfully, and other folks were on Zoom making comments successfully. So I'm really impressed with how staff has made this happen and utilize the technology so that people can feel comfortable participating in the process.
Okay. Hey, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it for today. Thanks, Leslie.
Okay. Thank you. That's Steinerville Basin Planning Commissioner Crystal Simons. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, last night, the Park City Community Foundation and Early Childhood Alliance brought in nationally recognized early childhood policy expert and author of the book Crawling Behind, America's Child Care Crisis and How to Fix It, Elliot Haspel. He joins me now in the studio along with Early Childhood Alliance Executive Director Kristen Schultz. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Before we jump in with Elliot, Kristen, maybe you can just summarize the research that was released last night by the Sorensen Impact Center on the most pressing early childhood issues facing Summit County.
Yes, thank you. So we had hired the Sorensen Impact Center to do a needs assessment and gap analysis of the early childhood landscape here in Summit County. And I encourage everyone to go to the Community Foundation website and download the report. It's very detailed. It's 60 pages long, tons of information. But in general, you know, we, and I think everyone kind of knows this intuitively, but we have a lot of resources in town. We don't have a great way of making sure that the families that are in the most need of those resources are able to access them. So one of their main recommendations is that we have more family navigators and maybe even a hub, you know, an early childhood hub that has kind of the no wrong door philosophy. So if a family comes in and they have a need, you know, we have a way to easily connect that family with the resources that we have in town to meet that need. And then I think we also, you know, there are several statistics that stand out in that report, but for me, one thing that was surprising was knowing that 1 in 4 of our pregnant women suffer from anxiety or depression. And I think that data actually predates COVID. And so I think we know that that is actually a higher number. So one of the things that the Early Childhood Alliance is kind of raising as a priority is really maternal mental health. It's so important to make sure that people have access to those resources. And in particular, we need more resources available in Spanish.
So. Any other surprises then by or something you didn't know?
You know, I think it's also interesting that 80% of the women with children under 6 are in the workforce. And so I think a lot of people don't realize the huge need that we have for childcare, and the licensed spots that we have don't come anywhere close to meeting the need. And so we really, a lot of our kids are in informal family, friend, and neighbor situations, which may be great, but they're unknown, right? And so we are really trying to increase access to high quality, affordable childcare to meet the need in our community.
Well, Elliot, let's bring you into it. Maybe just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how, and I guess why you focused your career on early childhood education and care.
Absolutely. So I work, my day job, I'm a program officer at a philanthropic foundation in Richmond, Virginia, and then I'm also a author of a book on child care policy and do sort of thought leadership work around child care policy. And I really got into this because I started my career in educational equity in the public school system. I was a 4th grade elementary school teacher, but I was noticing that really nowhere in the country was able to change the odds for children in terms of how much their zip code and the circumstances of their birth determine their outcomes. And so we, you know, you get a school here, school there that was able to help kids beat the odds, nor is changing the odds. And as more I looked into it, I realized a lot of this tracks back to birth, child development and the brain development in the early years. the outsized impact of the family in those early years are essential to the opportunities children have later in life. And so that really started to focus my work on the childcare, you know, sort of world of birth to five, which is so underfunded and so so disregarded, particularly related to, you know, thinking about our K-12 system.
So you talk about what you call your idealized system, basically that every child should have the unconditional right to quality early care and education starting at birth. I mean, it sounds very idealized, but I guess is it fair? Is it fair to, especially those people who choose not to have children because they know they can't take care of them and afford them? Because it's very expensive.
It is very expensive. I think what we want is we want a system that supports choice and pluralism. So we never want a couple that wants to have a child to be like, it's too expensive. I can't afford child care and child rearing costs, so I'm not going to have a kid, or I'm only going to have one kid, but I really want to have two. To me, when you think about freedom, when you think about self-determination, the ability to choose your family size should not be determined by whether or not you can afford to raise a child. And that's also bad for the community. If you think about economically, we're seeing the birth rate, you know, in America dropped to historic lows, and that has real implications down the line for our social safety net programs and for our economy writ large. So what we really want is, when I think about a right, I'm not talking about compulsory, I'm not talking about the way that we require everyone to go to, you know, the fourth grade, but for everyone to have the opportunity to access care that meets their needs, whether they want to stay home part-time, whether they want to access care through a faith community, whether they want to access care through a publicly funded child care center or family child care home. They should be able to do that. They should be able to afford it, and they should know that their child is going to a setting that is high quality with caregivers that are going to, you know, provide loving care and stimulation and help their children develop.
And certainly it would be great to have parents choose to be able to stay at home with their kids and give them that nurturing and that care and that education that they need. But we know, just based on your statistics, that 80% of those parents under six are in the workforce. So it's not a reality. And I guess then that probably goes along with kind of your second point, is that parents really should have to pay little to nothing beyond taxes for that care. So if that's the case, where does this money come from?
Yeah, so if you think about the public education system again, the difference between a child who is in the first grade and a child who's in, you know, preschool or child care is often 12 to 24 months of age. And so we have this weird system set up, and there's historical reasons for it, where from the time a child's born until that child is five or six, basically we're, as a society, like, good luck, parents, you're on your own. You know, if you're really, really low income, we might provide you with some meager support, but we're going to make you jump through a ton of hoops to get it. And then as soon as your kid turns to five or six, we're like, great, we got it from here. For the next, you know, 12 years, we are going to provide free universal, you know, education. And that's in the Utah state constitution. It's in all 50 state constitutions, in fact. And whereas in zero state constitutions is there a right to early care and education. And again, the only difference here is the children's age. So, you know, if you think about it, the United States spends $700 billion a year on K-12 education. And so if you talk about where the money comes from, it comes from government sources largely, you know, and it comes from a combination of, you know, some amount of parent contribution may be reasonable, you know, some amount of private sector contribution may be reasonable. But imagine if tomorrow we said to every parent of every middle and high school and elementary schooler, we're not going to pay for this anymore. You have to come up with your per pupil expenditure, you know, $10,000, $12,000 a year, where your kid can't go to the fifth grade, your kid can't go to junior year of high school. And, you know, the system would break down overnight. But that's what the situation we have left for the parents of our youngest children, who, again, are in the most critical period of brain development.
Yeah, and certainly then, right, we'd have third world problems, like, right, with an uneducated populace. I think that I guess then what kind of shifts that paradigm then? Again, I mean, it's it's difficult, right, to raise taxes, mm-hmm, to pay for teacher bonuses, teacher raises.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of a couple of things. I think one is the mind's understanding and shifting mindset that actually the early years are critical, and that we really want to support parents in their choices to be able to have their child in a high quality setting because of the impacts that has on education. So I think we still have a lot of people who think, you know, babies, infants, toddlers are basically kind of like sacks of potatoes that don't learn anything, you know, because they can't talk and they can't, you know, move very much. And so how are they actually learning? And so to continue to get that message across that actually they're there are upwards of a million neural connections happening every minute among our youngest children. I mean, there's a ton of learning happening. So that's one. The other thing is making an affordable, effective childcare system has this immediate return on investment in a way that almost no other social program does by increasing parental employment and in lots of cases, maternal employment. So we've seen this internationally in places like Quebec. We've seen this domestically in places like Washington, D.C. Every time you put into place very low cost or free childcare, almost immediately you see this flood of parents who are either entering the workforce for the first time or they're going to seek more hours or better jobs. And so Quebec, for example, makes money on their program because of the economic returns on it. And so part of it is also understanding that, yes, we need a big down payment, but more than almost any other thing we can do in sort of the help kids, this one, it pays for itself in the short term, and then it continues to pay dividends as the children, you know, don't have to be held back as many grades, as they don't have to access as many remediation services, as they're able to graduate high school and go to college at higher rates. We have those sort of medium and long-term returns on investment as well. So I think making that case that, yes, it's a big number, but it's well worth it.
So where's the money coming from? If it's a free program in Quebec, how is it that actually making money?
Yeah, it's just common. So the provincial government, you know, they put in the money through tax payer dollars, and then it comes back through economic returns. So if you think about the productivity, the tax base increases because you have more people who are in the workforce and therefore are paying taxes. For businesses, you know, and this is something that actually, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is one of the biggest supporters of sort of early childhood education in this country, because they say very clearly, like, this is an issue for the workforce of today, and this is an issue for the workforce of tomorrow. There's some estimates that the childcare crisis in the U.S. costs upwards of $57 billion in terms of lost productivity, because, you know, if you think about it, a parent who has to, childcare breakdown happens and they have to go and they have to leave work, or they can't take a job because they don't have childcare. You know, all of these situations happen every day and are causing, sort of economic shrinkage. So the money comes back through tax receipts.
Yeah, and I think that many, especially after the pandemic, that early care and practitioners pay, they should be well compensated and well trained and well supported. Do you have any statistics from that in terms of what COVID-19 did to our early childhood, education programs?
Yeah, so the first thing to understand is that with COVID is they exacerbated problems that were already there. So you mentioned the workforce. So in Utah, according to the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment out of UC Berkeley, the median wage for a childcare worker in Utah is $10.47, which means half of them are making less. Now that doesn't necessarily localize to Park City, but you can get a sense it's not gonna be a whole lot more than that. And so, when you have that level of compensation going on and you're seeing, as particularly in the moment, right, other kind of low-wage industries in the service and retail, right, McDonald's is raising their wages, Amazon and Target are up to a $15 starting wage. They're offering benefits. I think, ironically, some of them are offering childcare benefits as a way to sort of incentivize workers. It's really, really hard for childcare programs to compete because childcare programs can't just raise their prices. Parents can't pay any more, and they're not big corporations that can just get a little bit less profit. And so what COVID's really done is exacerbated a staffing shortage. So according to the National Association for the Education of Young Children, roughly 80% of childcare programs around this country are suffering from worker shortages. Unlike some of the other industries, there's no good path to getting them back.
Education is probably the most socialized program that this country has. And of course, that's a big thing that we hear about. I mean, it's like we're headed to socialism. I mean, it's really kind of this fear factor. But is that what it takes, though, to get to your kind of idealized system here?
So I don't think so, because again, I think there's a key distinction between government funded and government run. So think about Medicare. Medicare, the government funds the health care for seniors. A senior can take that money and go to a private health clinic, and they can use that, and the government will reimburse that private health clinic. So in early childhood, what we really talk about is what's called a mixed delivery system. What that means is that parents can access care delivered through public means, so, a Head Start program, a public pre-K program, or through private means, through something from a faith community, a family child, sort of a family that opens their home and has a business to take children in. And so really a pluralistic system that is based around parent choice, I mean, gets around that concern about it being sort of overly government run. So that's, I think, how we get around that. We can say this deserves public money, but parents should be able to access whatever kind of quality care they need and they prefer. Because the other thing is, you know, our K-12 system is fairly standardized, right? The hours. We know lots of parents, particularly of young children, have shifting needs. Some of them need care, you know, overnight because they work night shifts. Some of them need care part of the week, you know, and obviously we were in, you know, Park City was very seasonal, right? So needs are going to shift, you know, by the month, and we need a system that supports that. So even though our U.S. public education system tracks back to Thomas Jefferson and, you know, this late 18th century, the fact is we can learn from a lot of what's good about that, which is that everyone, regardless of income, can access it. They have a spot. There's no worry about that. And we can also learn from what doesn't work well in the public education system, the sort of overstandardization, the inequities along socioeconomic and racial lines. And we can build an early care and education system that really works for every parent and every kid.
Yeah, and we're still waiting. I mean, right? I mean, it's like you say, we've kind of had the same thing for decades, right? With nothing really shifting there. And I guess I believe you did offer some possible solutions last night. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, so there are a few different things that I talked about. One is that at the federal level, we have this the first moment in literally 50 years to really pass some significant legislation. And that's going to take, you know, advocacy at the local and state level as well. So in the sort of $3.5 trillion reconciliation bill framework, there is, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars in there for child care and for pre-K. And so that would be, you know, a really significant shift. The other thing is to think about this idea of local innovation. It's why I'm really, you know, very grateful for the work of the Alliance and the work of the Community Foundation, the work of PC TOTS and all of these other organizations is, you know, we're going to have to figure out wherever that money, when that money starts flowing, how do we actually implement it effectively? And it's going to need to look different in Park City than in Salt Lake City than where I come from in Richmond, Virginia. And so to have these local organizations who understand the needs of their local populations and are already sort of working on innovating ways to reach those families, to provide them what they're going to need, that's really essential. So being able to, you know, also support the work of the local infrastructure. And then the other thing is the local advocacy. So being able to talk with local elected officials, statewide elected officials, and eventually with federal, you know, elected officials, and this sort of two-way dialogue so that they're actually passing policy that will, when it comes back down to the local level, work as opposed to just, you know, sort of being, what we wouldn't want to see happen is all this money come and then it actually not be implemented effectively.
Yeah, yeah. So, Kristen, I'm guessing he's a breath of fresh air to your ears, huh?
Well, he is. I was telling Elliot when we were driving from the airport yesterday that I am buying everything he's selling. I just think he really does a nice job of encapsulating a very difficult issue. And so I think people that heard him last night were really kind of blown away. And as you can tell, Elliot has a ton of information, not only on the history and the causes of the broken kind of, it's not even a system, but our broken marketplace that we have now, but also some concrete solutions about what we can do to change it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess moving forward, what is this, you know, where do you go from here?
Well, so, you know, part of the Alliance, we are trying to look at everything related preterm through three. And so childcare is one of our focuses, obviously, but we're broader than that. But yeah, we are trying to raise money. PC TOTS, for example, is one of the organizations that isn't fully staffed. I think we have license capacity for 114 and we're nowhere near that because we can't hire the teachers. So if anyone out there is interested in early education, please contact PC TOTS. They're hiring. But it's also, I think it's working with the school districts, working with our home visitors, working with all of the local stakeholders that are part of our early education landscape and trying to figure out how we can do it better, how we can meet the needs, how we can fill the gaps. And part of the Sorenson Impact Center, you know, creates a whole system map of our early childhood system here in Summit County. And so we already have a head start. If we, you know, should we get an infusion of federal funding that comes through the state, I think we are going to be in a better position than some other, you know, local situations to really use it effectively.
Okay. Elliot, anything else you want to add?
Just that I think this is an issue that affects everyone, regardless of if they have kids. It truly is a community issue because, you know, the way that it trickles down to the health of our families, the health of our children, and ultimately the health of our economy and the health of our civic institutions. So, you know, it's something that I'm really grateful for from, you know, all the stakeholders and advocates who were there last night. And I really think everyone, whether they know it or not, is and should be an early childhood advocate. So I hope that everyone gets engaged as the, you know, conversation continues over these coming months.
Okay. Elliot Haspel, Kristen Soltz, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Well, Park City Police increased dump truck inspections on Marsac Avenue after a big crash in July, but Police Chief Wade Carpenter says that pulls resources away from other important areas of town. The Park City Council wants additional options to improve safety on the road. KPCW's Sean Higgins has details.
Park City Police Chief Wade Carpenter told the City Council last week that there has been an officer stationed on Marsac Avenue every day since a dump truck crashed through the Deer Valley Drive roundabout last month. He said officers have made several stops of trucks that are not in compliance at the brake check area across from the Ontario Mine, but a shortage of officers is making the efforts unsustainable.
Our biggest issue is resources and manpower as it comes to being able to enforce that. We're down 3 officers. We're not meeting our minimum staffing just to cover calls for service right now.
The city is exploring alternatives to take some of the stress off of the police department. Marsac Avenue is also State Route 224, and jurisdiction actually falls to the Utah Highway Patrol, so the city cannot impose steeper fines for offending trucks. Officials have submitted an emergency request to UHP for more enforcement, signage, and safety facilities. Dave Thacker is Park City's chief building official and told the council that altering the city's construction mitigation plan does provide them an enforcement option.
Adding a line item in that if there are violations, whether they be, you know, a truck that's not properly inspected and licensed, or whether that be a driver, or whether that be they're bringing in soil off the mountain and they shouldn't be, et cetera, right? We're looking at adding line items in there that the first violation is a stop work order for 24 to 48 hours, dependent upon what it is. Second violation, we'll double that or triple it. And the third one is an imminent stop until we can mitigate what's going on.
He added that stopping work for a period of time could affect a developer's bottom line, which could serve as an incentive. Councilor Steve Joyce said that may force contractors operating faulty trucks to get their equipment in better shape or lose business.
You do that enough times and that subcontractor either goes out of business or no developer wants to hire them, or they start passing back the cost to the truckers. And that's actually within our role. So I think we can start doing that more aggressively.
Thacker added that he has talked to the developers currently working in the Empire Pass area and said they all indicated a willingness to add amendments to their construction agreements.
I have not had any pushback about them agreeing to sign an addendum or something that would enhance their current construction mitigation plan to ensure the safety. There's not one person up there that wants to see this happen again either.
The City Council will receive an update on the Marsac enforcement in 6 weeks. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, Arts on the Trail, provided by the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County, is happening tomorrow. On the phone with details, I've got our council marketing manager, Leslie Chavez. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So what's happening?
All right. So Art on the Trails is coming up this Saturday from 2 to 6 in the afternoon. It's an annual program that we have that combines art and nature. So this free program takes guests on a walking tour of pop-up creative performances presented by local and regional performing and visual artists along the McLeod Creek Trail, in between Copper Moose Farm Stand and Temple Har Shalom here in Park City. And it's one of my favorite events that the Arts Council programs. It's put on in partnership with the Arts Council and Basin Recreation, with the support of our host sponsor, Copper Moose Farm Stand. And this year, the event has been made possible with the support of our presenting sponsor, Nordic Track from iFit, who we're just so grateful for. Okay. So we're really looking forward to the event.
All right. So where do people meet? I mean, do they park, what, at Willow Creek and walk somewhere?
Yeah, that's right. So we just asked people to arrive. So we've asked everyone to RSVP for a designated tour time. And then we ask people to arrive 15 minutes prior to that start time, park at Willow Creek Park, and then just walk on over to the Copper Moose Farm Stand to check in. And that's where our home base is going to be. We're going to have an Art on the Trails lounge with live performances, a food truck, and a cash bar. And you don't need tickets for that to attend that lounge experience.
Okay, so is the rest of it, the tours then free, or is there a ticket price to that?
The tours are totally free, and that's thanks to our presenting sponsor, Nordic Track by iFit.
Okay. So people can't just kind of do it on their own. They are part of another group, tour group?
That's right. We do have designated tours with site-specific locations where performers will be performing for the tours themselves. So although we have sold out We are going to be hopefully having tickets available day of. We're going to have a standby wait list. So if you come and hang out at the lounge, you can just kind of wait and see, check in with us and see if there's no shows. We'll be able to get you on a tour.
Okay. And what will people see on the tour?
Oh, man. Well, we have tons of amazing performing artists and visual artists. So we've got some poetry from our youth contestant winners from Poetry Out Loud, presented by Utah Division of Arts and Museums. We're going to have a trombone duet from Utah Symphony. Guitarist Zeus Garcia of Muse PC will be there. We're going to have a ballet dance by Michelle Wiles, accompanied by a Spanish guitar from Ballet Next. Flamenco dancing from Living Traditions Festival, an interactive art installation from Maya Story Weavers, and we're also going to have visual art installations along the trail as well from local artists.
Okay. Again, if people are interested, you can't reserve a spot on the tour, but you can come hang out there at the Copper Moose Farm Stand and see if you can get in.
Yeah, and at the Copper Moose Farm Stand, I wanted to mention, too, we're going to have live performances from Michelle Moonshine and Alicia Stockman, and that's going to be taking place the whole afternoon from 2 to 6, so you'll be able to enjoy live music. There's also going to be a taco truck, a cash bar, and the farm stand will be open for shopping, too.
Okay, how far of a kind of a tour is it?
So it's about 1.5 miles, very leisurely. It's going to take about an hour and a half.
Okay. All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
I just wanted to thank our presenting sponsor again, Nordic Track by iFit. And I just want everyone to come and join us on Art on the Trails. Like I said, if you were unable to RSVP, you can still join us at the lounge from 2 to 6.
Okay, Leslie Chavez with the Summit County Art Council. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a good one.
Well, after being canceled last year due to COVID-19, Swiss Days will be back in full swing the first weekend of September. KPCW's Ben Lassiter has more about that.
On Friday and Saturday, September 3rd and 4th, crowds in the thousands are expected to come to Midway from throughout Utah and beyond. An annual tradition since the 1940s, Swiss Days will offer an outdoor craft fair, 10K race, parade, live entertainment, and food booths with traditional dishes made on site. Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson says the community is ready and eager to welcome the enormous spectacle back to town after the missed year in 2020.
Enthusiasm is just mounting. And yes, people are very, very excited that it will be happening.
According to state tourism numbers, the festival is the second largest in Utah after Pioneer Day, with 100,000 people visiting Midway every September for the event. The festival began as a harvest celebration, then turned into a celebration honoring the Swiss pioneers who settled in the Heber Valley. To kick off the festivities, the market opens Friday morning at 8 a.m., and the first entertainers, Carrie and Ken, take the stage at 8:30. Performances will continue until 8 p.m. when the market closes. The Swiss Miss Royalty, a group of girls who put on a longtime community favorite traditional performance, go on at 3 o'clock Friday. Saturday's events begin at 7 a.m. when the 10K runners will take off and dishes are served at the Chuck Wagon Breakfast. Booths and performers go from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. again. Also on Saturday, the parade starts at 10 a.m. Johnson says for most people, the booths are the main attraction at Swiss Days.
Many, many, many of the booths are home-crafted or mom-and-pop type operations. So they're creative, beautiful, unique, you know, and that's, I think, one of the biggest things that people look for or the biggest reason they come. I would say the next biggest reason is the food.
Food favorites include the Swiss taco, a Navajo-style taco with shells made of scone dough. Vendors prepare these and other cultural meals on site, and volunteers from local churches serve. For more on Swiss Days and a full schedule of events, visit kpcw.org. Ben Lassiter, KPCW News.
Well, the 8th Annual Salt Lake Climbing Festival is happening this weekend. And on the phone with me with details, I have the Executive Director of the Climbers Alliance, Julia Geisler. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so when and where is this happening?
Yeah, this is our 8th Annual Salt Lake Climbing Festival. It's happening up at the Millicent Chalet at Brighton this Saturday and Sunday. And this is a fundraiser event raising money for the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance, which is your local nonprofit rock climbing advocacy and stewardship organization.
So how much are tickets?
Sure. So we still have, it's a weekend of climbing clinics sponsored by local guide outfitters, including our Park City guide outfitter, White Pine Touring. But the clinics are sold out, but we can still have people come up Saturday night at 4:30 to the Millicent Chalet, and tickets for that are $40, and they include dinner, live music, a huge vendor village with gear giveaways, and lots of fun lawn games to do. So again, it's a fundraiser for the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance over at the Millicent Chalet at Brighton this weekend, this Saturday night, starting at 4:30.
Okay, so this these clinics that have sold out, I mean, is it really something for everyone, from beginners to experts?
Absolutely. And you know, Leslie, this is Leslie I'm talking to, isn't it?
Yes.
I thought so. Anyway, yes, the climbing clinics are for everyone. Climbing clinics are geared towards elevating our climbing knowledge in the mountains. There's more climbers than ever since climbing just went to the Olympics. And so we're trying to elevate people's knowledge on the rock and limit climbing accidents out here in Wasatch.
Okay, and then you said you kind of have like a little village. I mean, who's going to be there?
Absolutely. Every outdoor industry brand that's local to Salt Lake. So Black Diamond is our title sponsor. And then we have, you know, Petzl, Liberty Mountain, Backcountry, the climbing gyms, Momentum in the front are going to be up there, and many, many more. So we hope people will come out and celebrate climbing in the mountains this weekend with us Saturday night. Go to saltlakeclimbingfestival.com and get tickets, and there will be a limited number at the door trying to get a head count. So please go online and get your Saturday night ticket. We hope to see everyone up there.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about just the concern? I'm not sure if it's from your group or not, but about the proposed gondola there going up Little Cottonwood Canyon and the impact that might have on the climbing areas?
Sure. So right now we have two proposals from UDOT on the table for Little Cottonwood Canyon. One is an 8-mile gondola, and the other is additional lanes in the canyon. Both of these will have pretty large impacts on the climbing resources, you know, the cumulative effect of losing parking and impacts to trails, impacts to just your climbing experience. Some boulder problems are in the line of the roadway widening. And so we're trying to have people comment before September 3rd deadline to UDOT on the Little Cottonwood EIS, and then after that, comment to your local representative so that we get the best solution for the canyon that works for all users.
Okay, Julie, anything else you'd like to mention?
Thanks for having me.
Julia Geiser is the executive director of the Salt Lake Climbers Alliance. Well, an emotional debate about mask mandates for Summit County school children took center stage before the Summit County Council Wednesday night, convening at the Legis Center in Colville. The council took public comment on the declaration of public health emergency and order of constraint. Those documents certified the county's order issued last weekend, saying that masks would be ordered if any elementary school in the county reaches a 2% 14-day positivity rate in its entire campus population of students, faculty, and staff. In the hearing, 9 people spoke against the mandate, all of them appearing in person. 12 people supported the mandate, with one exception, they were on Zoom. Among the comments, Elizabeth Smith said that the mask order is about fear, not data. She said the beginning of the pandemic was marked by panic and irrational choices.
Basic virology went out the window. The 14-day to flatten the curve devolved into, we must close down everything except Walmart and shelter in place. This released unprecedented restrictions on economic and medical freedoms and destroyed an untold number of lives and livelihoods in the process, including my 9-year-old sons.
Joanne Funseth said that the pandemic restrictions have been mentally and emotionally damaging to our youngsters.
Imagine the effects of learning that breathing the air is dangerous, that their friends can make them sick, and that hugging their grandparents could kill them. For any parent encouraging their kids to wear masks, I would invite them, visit the classroom for a day, better yet a week. Wear the mask alongside your child. Measure your physiological effects, and imagine the impacts of your kids trying to learn through the muffled voice of a teacher.
Other critics said more effective ways to curb the virus in school would include improved air circulation, hand washing, and other sanitation measures, and keeping sick kids at home. Following a lineup of mask opponents, a county employee stepped up to speak, Brian Craven, who was usually present to operate the Zoom technology and to monitor the time for each speaker. He said his two-year-old granddaughter has had COVID three times and now is suffering lung problems. He asked the audience if they want her to die. As a verbal altercation broke out, Councilmember Doug Klein reprimanded the audience and Acting Council Chairman Chris Robinson called for order.
Hey, hey, stop.
We haven't cut anybody off.
Stop. We haven't even asked you not to applaud, for crying out loud. You've behaved really like a bunch of hooligans.
Please direct your comments at us, Brian.
And I apologize, I did not start the timer. Because I'm not here with a prepared speech. I'm not going to go over 3 minutes. I'm not part of a concerted effort to get everybody out to complain to these poor men and women about a mask mandate. I'm asking you, are you willing to let my granddaughter die because you can't see past the nose on your face? Really, a wise man once said, love thy neighbor as thyself. I wear a mask not for me, but for you. I would ask you to do the same.
Council also heard from Greg Hatfield, a Park City resident, parent, and ICU nurse at Primary Children's Hospital. He said last winter, during widespread masking, their ICU facility was nearly empty, not only of COVID, but other respiratory illnesses. Last week, Primary Children's reported that its ICU had surpassed 100% capacity. It's 9 o'clock. You've been listening to the local news hour here on KPCW Park City. Again, a big thank you for a very successful pledge drive. We appreciate all your support of local news and information.